Hello and welcome to Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason Papier.
And I'm Peter Johnson.
And we are coming to you with the second half of the Bill Sharp interview this week.
And for those of you that didn't tune in to that discussion, we invite you to go back and listen to it. For those of you that don't know Bill Sharp, he's a Nobel Prize winning giant in finance and economics and portfolio development. Going back some 40 years in his research, all kinds of accolades. We have the bio on the website, you know, author, former president of the American Finance Association, Stanford professor, really someone worth listening to, who I think brings some real perspective to this process of investing as opposed to gambling or betting. So this is the second half of the conversation because it was a little long. It was a little over an hour, so we thought we'd break it up into two parts.
Yep. Now, to get the first show, go to our website. That is promoneytalk.com. And you can also get the show notes from this show, from the first show, and you can listen to our older shows there. While you're there, you can also sign up for our mailing list. If you're a member of the mailing list, you're going to get an alert every time we have a new show, and as we have special items that may come up, we will let you know. You can also give us a call on our new phone number. It's area code 206-250-3428. And we're encouraging our listeners to call in and leave a message asking a question. We're going to take those questions and we're going to answer them on air, try and get to one a show or so. And if we get enough, we may even have interstitial shows where we just cover questions and have professionals give answers to them. So without further ado,
well, so far we've been talking about things that are sort of efficient, but you've also said that you're kind of a fan of behavioral finance.
I am very much a fan of behavioral finance. I've been, before it was called that, I guess, being interested in some of the earliest work in cognitive psychology. I'm hardly an expert, but I am a consumer of some of that. And one of the reasons that I went the route of this, doing this simulator, is that it allows me at least to look at equilibrium in situations where people do have certain characteristics that are consistent with what cognitive psychologists have found over the years, and see what that implies for both the portfolios they choose and for the asset prices. And to wildly oversimplify, at least what you find in some of the experiments I've done, is that these kinds of behavioral aspects cause people to hold portfolios that are not a market index fund plus borrowing and lending, but they may not have that much effect on asset prices. So I think it's always important to differentiate between exceptions to the very simple assumptions of the earliest equilibrium models, exceptions in terms of what people choose to hold as portfolios, and indeed should hold as portfolios, and what those models say about prices. I think the big message of the earliest equilibrium models is what I like to call the market risk-reward theorem, and it comes in various flavors, but it basically says that the most extreme version says only market risk is rewarded with higher expected return. And by market risk, I mean, as I said perhaps earlier, the risk of doing badly in bad times for the society as a whole. And that big message with variations seems to be pretty robust, even when you introduce people having differences in predictions, people have differences in outside positions, and people having radical differences in their preferences, including some of the behavioral aspects. Now, again, that's not something I can prove, but if you build worlds, as we've said, that have some of these kinds of differences in them, and you investigate, as the simulator is designed to help you investigate, the extent to which that market risk reward theorem holds, you find that doesn't hold exactly, of course, but it holds reasonably well in a number of these richer worlds, which presumably come closer to the real world that we live in.
So if I hear you correctly, behavioral finance is a real thing. People do behave irrationally from time to time, but it doesn't really have a huge impact on the markets in the longer run.
Well, that's a sweeping statement. I'm not sure I can sign off on all of that, but I'm led to believe that it has a relatively small impact on risk-reward relationships in the markets. That's not to say it doesn't have an impact, and it's not an impact that you shouldn't try to assess and take into account. But to the first point, certainly our experience at Financial Engines and everyone's daily observance is people do not all hold a market index fund plus borrowing and lending. And the simplest of the original capital asset pricing model said, well, that's what everybody should do. Now, people don't do that. Whether they should do that or not is another issue, but they, as a prediction of what people do, that fails miserably, always has, always will. And I think we're beginning to understand that some of the things that people do are consistent with their best interests. Many of them are not. And one of the things we work very hard at Financial Engines is trying to help people sort out what's consistent with their interests in terms of investment practice and what isn't. And we've certainly become students of behavioral finance. We work very hard. One finds, for example, if you show somebody two pieces of information and one number is in red and the other is in black, you'll get a different decision than if you change the colors. And if you make one bigger or if you use a particular icon or you put something in a particular place on the page. So we go through agony working with individuals, with focus groups, with test cases to try to communicate information and to phrase questions and elicit information and provide information back through the interactive process in a way that will cause people not to do something inferior in terms of their own interests. And we have to know a lot intuitively and formally about behavioral psychology, not just behavioral finance, to do the best job we can of that. So definitely, people do behave in interesting ways. There's a marvelous body of research now where psychologists and economists and financial people are literally wiring people up, posing different kinds of financial questions to them and seeing where the blood is moving in the brain. And there are some experiments in that area I adore. I don't know if you want me to take the time. Let me just briefly describe one that I think is wonderful, and I'll probably mischaracterize it. But two groups of people, one group is given a fairly hard task, memorizing a bunch of maybe 7 or 8-digit numbers and being able to recall them on request. The other is given an easier task. Maybe they're 5-digit numbers or something of that sort. So each of these groups, they're working away, doing their thing, and midway through, in one group, they come in, on both groups, they say, would you like a snack? And we have chocolate cake and a fruit plate. And the net result is that the people who are really working hard are more likely to take the chocolate cake, and not all, but more of them than not, and vice versa. And they've actually, I think, now even wired up to see what parts of the brain are functioning. And the explanation is that the people with the hard task have pretty well occupied the prefrontal cortex, which is where you do things very carefully and intelligently and rationally. So when the decision for the snack comes, they send it back to the old part of the brain, the lizard brain, which says, go for the chocolate cake, it tastes better. Whereas the other people, still have computing capacity left at the front and can say, well, the chocolate cake tastes better, but the fruit's going to be better for me and there are calories. So they tend to make a more calculated response.
That explains a lot of things.
Well, you think about that in terms of the investment process. And you think about, and I'll bet you, you know, you tell me, but I'll bet you in your work, you know, you have tricks in which you can work with a client to try to get them to focus on their attention using the calculating part of their brain rather than the instinctual, let's go for what, let's go by the gut. Mm-hmm. I'll bet you work at that.
I've worked from day one on trying to communicate clearly to clients and not overwhelm them. I realize for a lot of people when they walk into the office, it's like this huge mental shift that's very difficult for them, and they may understand while they're there, but they're going to forget it 5 minutes later. So I've thought of about a million and one different metaphors for things. And I try to make it, try to make pictures for people. I try to build their confidence. And sort of what I was thinking about going to next in a conversation was the value that advisors add, which a big part of that is just bringing perspective. Many people feel comfortable with, say, real estate or with bonds or with stocks, but not with the other asset classes. Just the fact that we get them out of that one area and into a variety is a huge plus.
You mentioned metaphor. When we first started, there were naysayers, many of them, who said, well, you can't get people to think about the probability that they will meet their goals in retirement. You know, people want an estimate, and most of the people doing automated financial projections were saying, you will retire with X dollars per year. And so the question was, how are we going to get people to relate to, there's a 70% chance you'll retire with X dollars per year, but there's a 30 or more, but there's a 30% chance you'll retire with less. And we tried this, we tried that, and finally someone came up with the idea, just asked the question, where in normal life do you run into probabilities? Although there's been a bit of a tendency, a movement back, a regression from that, but at least at that time the answer was weather forecasts. 30% chance of showers. So we came up with little icons. And so if you had a really high probability of meeting your goals, you've got sunshine and white fluffy clouds. And if you had a very low chance, you've got thunderstorms and lightning and black skies. And that did wonders because people could relate. Aha, hey, yeah, I'm used to thinking probabilistically about weather. Everybody knows that at least weathermen can't tell you for sure if it's going to rain tomorrow. And so the best I can hope for is there's an 80% chance. Maybe that'll be information. And so, again, I think metaphors are incredibly important, metaphors, analogs, similes, what have you, in trying to get people to relate to the problem. But it is. It's terribly important to engage people. Let me give you one other result from the behavioral experiments, which is fascinating. If you tell somebody, look, would you rather have a dollar 10 years from now or a dollar 25 11 years from now, they'll generally say, I'll take the dollar 25. I'm willing to wait the year. But then if you say, well, would you rather have a dollar now or a dollar 25 a year from now, they'll say, I think I'll take the dollar now. And, you know, what's that all about?
It's the same thing.
and you know, apparently it's we're talking now, so it goes to the back of the brain where it says, you know, I'd better get the meat before the dinosaur comes and stomps on me. Whereas the others, well, it's 10, 11 years from now. That's something I can intellectualize and think about in a very calculated and rational way.
Well, taking into account how people think and react and feel is essential and hard to anticipate or quantify, but maybe that's one of the best uses of behavioral understanding around finances, to use it in the reverse way, not how does it affect markets, but how does it affect individuals, and learn how to communicate well with people. Because we have so many people that are math-averse. You know, you bring up a number or a calculation, and I have clients that keep trying to bring me back to, well, I don't really want to know the percentage return. I want to know how much money did I start with and how much money did I end with. Forget about the time period. Almost forget about whether there were any withdrawals or contributions. Just tell me what I started with and what I ended with.
Yeah, and I think in the retirement, in the saving and investing for retirement, what they really want to know, they want to have actually an image, I think, in their head of how they're going to be living in their so-called golden years. And, you know, you've seen, we've all seen the ads and the brochures of the happy couple out playing golf and playing tennis and drinking wine and at the dinner table. But that's basically what matters. And my utility, if you will, my happiness is a function of tangible standard of living, not of some hocus-pocus about means and standard deviations of return on this or correlation with that or asset classes. Asset classes are just vehicles. And the extreme case of that, and we certainly see that a lot, comes when people say, I don't need to know about whether real estate tends to go up when stocks go up. I don't even need to know about real estate investments. I don't need to know about index funds. Just let me work with you to give you a sense of how much risk I'm willing to take in terms of what matters to me in order to have a hot, better prospect in terms of what matters for me, and then you do it. And so we're seeing in the 401k domain, there are people who want to be engaged in the process with a person, with an automated system, with both, perhaps. And there are people who really don't. And you're an expert. As long as you know enough about my situation and my preferences, then I'll trust you to do the work that requires expertise in the investment area. That requires trust, obviously. You know, I have to trust that you're knowledgeable, you're skilled, and you don't have some other agenda. But once we get past that, that may be the answer for lots of people.
I think of it as a continuum from the people who want me to do everything to the people who want to learn enough to eventually do it on their own. And I encourage them and support them to do that.
Absolutely.
So another big topic, but I think very interesting, is the impact of technology on financial advice. That we're sort of taking out the middleman in a lot of areas. The access to information is there for people that want it. The lower prices in the financial markets, the customization of financial products, perhaps down the road, the, you know, dial in your derivative to what you need kind of thing. I'm sure you have some thoughts on that, you know, there's more maybe access to good information like through financial engines and that sort of thing.
Well, the landscape is obviously radically different than it was 5 years ago, let alone 10, 15, or 20. And it will be radically different 10 years from now, I fully expect. I think it's useful to go back again to sort of the investing versus betting syndrome. We have lots of instruments that can help you and be a better investor. Use the markets to achieve things that are important for you, given your personal individual circumstances. We also have lots of instruments that can be used to make big bets against the other guys. And especially for an individual who is not highly skilled and doesn't devote pretty much full time to the investment business, making big bets is almost certainly a bad idea. And so the plethora of instruments and information has both a bright side and a dark side. And you only have to go back to the day trading madness. The most poignant case, a wonderful, very smart guy who was at the time travel agent I worked with was complaining, this was before the bubble burst, about the fact that it was getting really tough to be a travel agent. There was a lot of you know, the fees were being squeezed and this was happening and that was happening and people were booking online, as probably most of us do now. And I said, so he said, I think I'll get out of the travel agent business. I said, what are you going to do, Tom? He said, well, I've started day trading, and I've been making some money.
No.
Well, and I, needless to say, said, Tom, you know, don't quit your day job. I lost track of him, so I don't know how it all worked out. But certainly the idea that a bunch of us can make money trading stocks frequently with each other, even if the cost per trade is low, it's not zero. And, you know, we're taking risk that we needn't take and that on average is not going to be rewarded. So I think betting is best left to professionals, and even then you have to have a professional that's better than the other professionals, because most professionals who bet are betting against other professionals, and it's a zero-sum game, and actually after costs it's a negative-sum game, just the arithmetic of the case. So wonderful opportunities, wonderful instruments, lower costs to make people better able to invest in ways that meet their personal requirements, and people differ. So it's important to meet your personal requirements. You're different than I am. You should be investing differently than I do. And we now have instruments and organizations and individuals that can help us do that more efficiently. But, you know, I worry that a lot of what I see is being used, at least in part, for making bets that are really too big and more dangerous than they should be, and really are counterproductive, not productive.
I certainly see some of that going on out there, too. People who feel stressed and feel the need to make money quickly, and they go out and do their thing.
Yeah. I mean, if it were as easy, I mean, we see this in the institutional world. Returns are lower than they used to be. I've got to meet an actuarial rate of 8.25%. I'm going to have to make some bets, as if it were that easy. You know, if you could make extra money by making bets, why weren't you doing it before?
So even the professionals are human.
The professionals I know are very human, indeed.
I sometimes joke that my dysfunctional upbringing helped me dissociate from feelings, and that has a good place in sometimes in financial advice, because I can kind of back away from some of the emotion.
Well, we're probably talking too much about behavioral research, but there's some recent research at Stanford, actually. I've only read summaries of it, so I can't give the details, but it's fascinating. They did some experiments with people who'd had a particular kind of brain damage, and it turned out that, as I understand it, the ones who had lost the part of the brain that deals with values and morals and ethics took more risk and behaved more like CEOs of major companies. Now, I'm probably overstating the results, and again, I didn't read the careful paper.
You heard it here first.
but there's this feeling that there are some issues there. I mean, it's frightening as we learn more about the brain and how decisions are made in various parts of the brain. It's a little bit frightening to think about how much more we're going to know and the dangers that someday you may be able to manipulate your clients by wiring, you know, putting them in an MRI machine when you do the first interview.
We just bribe them with M&Ms when they come in.
That's much better.
They've already had the irrational part, you know, taken care of, so they're ready to do the work. I was curious, who are some of the current pioneers in finance that are worth keeping an eye on, and is there any recommended reading or tools or resources that you would point us to?
Well, I'm not that current with some of the leading edge research, if you will, just because I'm not at the university every day and I'm not as exposed to some of the newer things as I once was and would like to be. But
anything in the last 5 years would do for me.
Well, I'm very impressed with the work John Cochrane is doing John is at Chicago, and he and some of his students have been doing some really wonderful work. He has a marvelous book on asset pricing, also Princeton Press, as it turns out, which is it's an advanced level textbook, but he's been doing some fascinating work. Some other work that I like a lot is being done by John Campbell at Harvard and his students, who are now at various universities, former students, and they've been looking at some of the life cycle issues. The whole idea, I mean, the ultimate investing problem for an individual is, you know, you're born, you're going to be here for a while, you're going to die. Some of that period you're going to earn money, and some of that period, all that period you're going to spend it, but some of it you're going to earn more than you spend, and other parts of your life you're going to spend more than you earn, or maybe earn nothing through normal salary and wages. And the question is, how do you choreograph that? Obviously, that entails saving some of your earnings during the accumulation phase and then spending it during the decumulation phase, the retirement phase, and investing it while you've got it, buying life insurance perhaps when you're young, buying annuities perhaps when you're old. So all those issues of how do you allocate resources over time and over states of the world involving things like are you alive or are you dead in 2016, all those issues are basically what investments and insurance is all about. And I increasingly believe, especially as we deal with people in their retirement years, which is an area that I'm working on now, we need to think about investments and insurance more seamlessly. We've tended to think about investment as one activity and insurance as another. And yeah, there are variable annuities, but those are really mostly investment vehicles. But I think we need to see, and we will see, more integration of the two fields, both in terms of academic and theoretical work, but also in terms of practice and professional activities. And there's very good work in that area going on. Olivia Mitchell at Wharton has done, and a number of people who work with her, Jim Perturba has done some very good work in this area, and a number of people looking at these issues.
So sort of smoothing out the flow of money through one's lifetime.
Yeah, the simple way of characterizing it is sort of lifetime, you know, life cycle, lifetime consumption. And if there weren't risk in the world, it would be very simple. We would probably aspire to have a reasonably constant level of spending from the day we go to work till the day we die. But there's risk. And there's a reward for bearing risk, at least the right kind of risk. So you need to take that into account. So it gets more complicated, and that's why we have all this apparatus of Monte Carlo simulation and optimizers and risk and return and all the things that investment theory has dealt with. And what I foresee is a tighter integration of that with insurance, because insurance is designed to deal with risks that are personal. Will I die? Will I need lifetime care? You know, will I have to go to a skilled nursing? Whereas investments deal predominantly with risk that is more general. Will oil prices go up? Will the stock market fall? And we need to integrate those two. And especially when you're dealing with investment and insurance issues in the retirement years, what I call retirement economics, which is, as I said, that's the area I'm devoting my research to pretty much at the moment, for probably reasonably obvious reasons.
You're just trying to help me out as I get older?
There you go. Uh-huh. I'm concerned about your retirement.
Good, I am too. Well, this is outside the box completely, but I wondered if you had any thoughts on balance of trade, foreigners holding U.S. dollars, outsourcing, protectionism, changing demographics, kind of the current economic things that also get into the political area, because I personally have an agenda here that people don't understand economics very well, and they do things that maybe are not in the best national interest. And I don't know, I don't want to load the question for you, but if you have any thoughts quickly.
Well, my sort of the blanket answer is that that's macroeconomics and monetary economics, which are not my areas of expertise. So anything I would say, and I'll say maybe one or two things, is approximately as valuable as what you could get by going out and stopping someone on the sidewalk and asking them. So with that caveat, I'm a reasonably traditional economist in that I believe that it's possible for almost everybody, and in principle everybody, to be better off if people are allowed to enter into trade willingly. Now, there's no doubt about it, when you engage in foreign trade and outsourcing, in the first instance, some people will almost certainly be worse off. There's no question about that in most of these realistic scenarios. And the question is, can you reallocate the gains from those that gain from say, global trade in a way that compensates those that lose? Because the gains will almost certainly be larger than the losses when you go across the whole population of the people affected. But if you don't make that reallocation, then you're making a judgment that net-net, I'd rather see these people have big gains, even though I know those people have perhaps smaller losses or there are fewer of them. That's a value judgment, and that's very much a political and moral and ethical judgment. Touch that one. But on the other hand, it seems to me really important to find ways to make it feasible and responsible and desirable to get the gains from broader interaction, broader trade, more open financial markets, more open markets in goods, more open capital markets. And, if the Chinese and the Japanese want to send us net-net a lot of goods, and for that matter the Middle East, in return for pieces of paper that they're going to put in their vaults, if they'd like to do that forever, that's just great for us. Now, obviously, they're not going to want to do that forever. And so ultimately, we'll have to pay for this spending binge that we're on, both publicly and privately. And that concerns me, as it concerns, I think, almost everybody who thinks deeply about it. But again, the answer is not, I hope, to build a wall around the borders and say, okay, we're just going to trade with ourselves and do business with ourselves and engage in financial activities with ourselves. Because if that's a good idea, let's build a wall around California. That'll be even better.
I thought maybe I would only buy my car if it was made in Los Altos.
Absolutely. Well, I live in Carmel by the Sea. We're at 1 square mile. Why, we can just build a wall around Carmel by the Sea and
here's an idea.
Leave it open on the ocean side so we have access to the water. That's not the answer. But free, untrammeled trade, outsourcing, global capital markets, without any concern for those that in the first instance are damaged, is, I think, to me, an unacceptable political and societal reaction. That's a value judgment on my part. But there's got to be something in the middle. And the something involves, by my lights, given my values at least, involves helping the people who are damaged rather than killing the goose.
I am really glad that I got into a good school and learned about economics and things, because I was a hippie liberal type when I was a kid, and I still have liberal social values, but I'm so thankful for the knowledge of how the world works at large, where a lot of people don't seem to have that, that they think all corporations make 50% and it's all driven by greed, and I have a little different picture of it now than I used to.
No, I think people tend to assume that economists, especially financial economists, are very conservative in almost every respect that term is sometimes used. And that need not be the case. Many are not. it's very hard to understand, or at least to practice, economics without having an appreciation for the advantages of allowing people to enter into transactions that they believe, at the time at least, are in their mutual best interests. It's very hard to argue against that, at least in a widespread way. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that you're callous.
I liked your, at the end of the book, you said, it's time to conclude this chapter in the book. We do so with four pillars of sound personal investment advice. Stated as verbs, they are diversify, economize, personalize, and contextualize.
I fought hard to find a better word for the fourth point that wasn't so opaque, because it's not clear, at least to most people, what I might mean by that. But let me go down the list. Diversify is, very often people say in real estate the three major most important principles are location, location, location. And people often say in investments the three most important principles are diversify, diversify, diversify. And that's, simply put, why take risk for which there's no reward? Why take risk that has no particular prospect of a higher expected return? And so the free lunch in investing, if you will, is diversification. You can radically cut the risk. Why put huge amounts of money in company stock? Maybe a great thing for loyalty and for incentives. It's a rotten investment decision. You've already got your human capital in the company to a greater or lesser extent. Why put lots of your money in any single stock? It just doesn't make sense. So diversification. If you do nothing else, please, listener, diversify. Economize. Unfortunately, there are ways of spending a lot of money in the investment world which will be just down the rat hole. Costs, transactions costs, broadly construed. Why would you ever want to pay somebody 2% a year of your money to buy a portfolio of 100 publicly traded stocks? I mean, that person would have to walk on water to justify that kind of expense. There may be such people out there, but there aren't very many of them. And more often than not, if you're going to pay that kind of expense, say, for a mutual fund that's broadly diversified in the public markets, you're spending money needlessly. And you might think, well, what's 2%? But that's 2% out of maybe a total return that you could likely expect of 8, 10% perhaps. So that's 2 out of 10. That's 20%. And that means you'll be, in some sense, 20% poorer in terms of all the money that you expect to earn from here until you need the money, say, when you retire. So costs are important. You need to have a very good reason to believe that you're getting value for the extra money. You can invest broadly in highly diversified portfolios very, very cheaply these days. So that's your benchmark. Personalize. When we build simple theories, we don't put much context and much texture in them, and so people are very, very simple in our simple theories because we have to make them simple to make the theories simple. But real people aren't simple. I live in a different place than you live. I have different real estate holdings than you have. I'm a different age than you are. I may have a different attitude towards risk than you do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those differences should affect how I invest. I should invest differently than you do because I'm different. And so it's terribly important that one way or the other you get good advice and good assistance and or a good manager, good planner, a good counselor to help you build the investment strategy that is right for you. It's not a matter of beating markets. This is a matter of personalizing your investment and insurance, I might say, strategy to your particular circumstances and preferences. And then the contextualize, the somewhat pedantic word, when you or your advisor create an investment plan for you, you're buying, by and large, securities in public markets. Those securities are being bought at a price. That price is being determined by the interaction of huge numbers of investors around the world. You need to understand, or your advisor does, enough about the process that determines those prices so that he, she, or you can make a rational decision in terms of what you should hold. Should you hold more than your proportionate share of securities in the U.S.? Well, you have to think about why those securities are priced and by whom they're priced. They're priced by investors around the world. So without having some notion of what we call pedantically asset pricing theory or equilibrium theory, the process by which prices are set, the arrangements that lead to certain risk-return trade-offs, you can't make a decision. Your advisor can't help you make a decision. You go to an expert if you go to an expert because the expert knows something about how much return you can reasonably expect to get for bearing certain kinds of risk. That requires an understanding of capital markets and what we in the academy have been working on for decades and will continue to work on for decades, equilibrium asset pricing theory. So you need to make your decision in the context of the markets in which you're operating and the markets from which you're selecting investments. So those, I think, are, as I tried to summarize the key ideas from a long and perhaps somewhat tedious book, as they relate to actually choosing portfolios, giving investment advice, taking investment advice, those were basically the key words I came up with.
Fantastic. I think that'll be helpful to many, many people. And it's wonderful to be able to hear them from you directly. So thank you for spending time with me and with our listeners.
Well, let me say it's been a great pleasure, and it's particularly exciting to have a chance to participate in this relatively new medium. And I thank those who've listened to it for listening to it, and wish you the best of success with your investments.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, thanks, Peter. That wraps up the second half of the interview with Bill Sharpe, and it was very enlightening.
Well, I really appreciate the thoughtfulness he puts into each answer and how carefully he considers ideas and really how clearly he presents them. He is an educator, after all.
Well, to get more information about the show, as we mentioned earlier, go to our website, promoneytalk.com. You can also sign up for our mailing list there. And if you have any questions that came up while you were listening to the show, or just any questions that you have at all about financial planning, go ahead and give us a call, area code 206-250-3428, and we will play it on the show and we'll answer it on the show.
And maybe we should mention the Voice Indigo service, the ability to listen to our podcasts and others on your cell phone.
Absolutely. On the website, you can, there's a link on the homepage that says mobilize the latest episode. Simply click on that and you'll be able to get it on your cell phone. You type in, it brings you to a Voice Indigo page. You type in your cell phone number and the show pops up on your cell phone. It's pretty amazing.
I had a little challenge trying it on my cell phone, but it might be because it's an older phone or I missed some step in it. But clearly the future that you'd be able to get audio programs like podcasts on different kinds of devices while you're on the go, and it's just fantastic.
It's really neat. You can share it. There's a whole menu once it's on your phone. You can share the show with friends who you think might be interested. Send it directly to their cell phone. It's really, really fun and really interactive, and I agree with you, Peter.
And it's free.
And it's free. Yeah.
That dead word.
Right, sorry.
That four-letter F word.
That's right. Thanks again for listening to the show. And until next show, I'm Jason.
And I'm Peter.
And here's to your success.